Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Alex Finley. Alex is a former CIA officer. Be careful what you say around her. And I should say she worked in operations, not analysis, former spook, who now writes about these issues, security issues. We'll discuss the FBI Inspector General's long-anticipated report on the FBI surveillance of various Trump insiders during and after the 2016 campaign, and about Attorney General William Barr's refusal to accept the conclusions of that investigation. But first, I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, alternate managing editor, Elizabeth Preza. Hi, Liz. How are you?
Hi, Josh. I'm great. How are you?
Ugh, I'm tired. It's been a long day. I had a big mess with appliance deliveries today.
Refrigerator running?
Like, they give you my refrigerator is not running, actually. I have all my shit in a cooler. Yeah, but they gave me the window. You know the window? They're like, yeah, we'll be there between 5 and 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. They started at 9:30 p.m., a.m., right? When I was at the gym, they're like, hey, we're coming over. And then we're trying to record this interview, and that's when they came with the rest of it. So two different deliveries. And they never managed to fit the fridge up the stairs. That had to be.
Oh, jeez. The window is just a suggestion then.
The window is like, yeah, it's just to make you think that there is a plan.
Got it.
There is no plan. That's you know, clear. Before we get to Alex Finley, it looks, according to the exit polls, as if Boris Johnson, the Brits version of Donald Trump, is his conservative government is going to trump the liberals led by Corbyn. Mm-hmm. Already you see this very lazy punditry coming about, you know, how Democrats have to hew to the center to avoid this kind of disaster next year. And I say it's lazy, so I expect it to be widespread. Honestly, just the fact that they have a parliamentary system, multi-party parliamentary system, just the fact that they can call another election if need be, the fact that they are just divided for 4 years by Brexit, and we are not so far debating secession or breaking up the country, although maybe that would be a good idea. All of those things make this just exceptionally stupid. Right. And by the way, Politico reported that Boris Johnson and Donald Trump have been pretending that they're not close friends because they judge that, you know, Trump is less popular than, I don't know, what's something that's really unpopular in England? The French. Like, he's less popular than the French. And so they were like, yeah, I don't know that Boris Johnson guy. But it turns out that Johnson has been... He got close to Trump in part by currying favor with Stephen Miller by giving him writing tips.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's gross.
Yeah, it's all pretty gross.
That's gross.
What's been on your radar this week, Liz?
Well, this week in Giuliani Watch, we had some interesting news come out of Horowitz's testimony yesterday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Judiciary.
Senate, it was intelligence.
No, it was judiciary.
Okay.
But apparently there's an ongoing investigation into the FBI leaks to Rudy Giuliani about the Hillary Clinton investigation currently at the Inspector General's office, which I found really fascinating.
So was that the New York field office?
Yeah, that was leaking information about the Clinton investigation to Giuliani in 2016.
It's funny how everything is projection.
I know. I mean,
the FBI helped Trump so much. they went out of their way not to talk about the investigation into Russiagate, and they blathered on about, you know, investigations into Hillary's whatever email.
Yeah, and people hated Hillary Clinton in the FBI. I remember these stories coming out at the time where it was like, yeah, they hate her. They don't want her to win. And then all of a sudden Donald Trump won and it was like, no, the FBI the entire time has been in the bag for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Like that was ever a reality.
It's crazy. It is really crazy. Speaking of Giuliani and impeachment and everything else, the Senate is reportedly considering not calling witnesses. This is after for the impeachment trial when it moves after the New Year's. This is after months of caterwauling by House Republicans about not being able to call witnesses, like, I don't know, Hunter Biden or Paula Jones or maybe the guys who started that Benghazi movie. I don't know who they wanted to have like a big show. And now this is causing a rift between Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Trump White House. And some of those same House Republicans who wanted to, quote, fight fire with fire. But the problem for them is that the Democrats' witnesses were mostly regime officials or former officials, and they were very compelling. And they were certainly far more compelling than the Republicans who were badgering them. And
right.
I guess Mitch McConnell knows he has to kind of defend the indefensible here and just wants to get through it as quickly as possible. Again, Trump is pressuring him to do something very different. We'll see how that all plays out.
He wants like a big show.
Yeah, he wants a big show. They want to call Biden. They want to call Schiff. They want to call Hunter Biden. They want to call, you know, who knows?
People
related to their various and sundry conspiracy theories.
Interesting. I read that Trump is considering coming to McConnell's side on that, and just letting them do, you know, a speedy trial.
Yeah, I mean,
it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, definitely.
Yeah. What else is going on?
Well, you know, we have the holidays coming up.
Yes.
So it's just about the time for Trump to give a big speech about Jewish people and how they don't love Israel enough, but they're going to vote for him despite hating him because their businesses are going to go under if Democrats take the White House. So, you know, we have this lovely speech from Donald Trump. I guess it was 2 days ago at this point.
It's amazing how this guy gets away with like this ridiculous, blatant anti-Semitism. He said there was the line that I liked was, and I quote, "A lot of you are in the real estate business because I know you very well. You're brutal killers, not nice people at all." It's amazing. Geez. And he gets away with it. And you know, I don't know. It's crazy. But that kind of brings me to this weird kerfuffle that we had this week with the New York Times. They got everyone riled up with a story about an executive order by Donald Trump that would reclassify Judaism as a nationality as well as a religion, supposedly. Alan Dershowitz, whom Trump is reportedly considering adding to his impeachment team, was very excited about this.
Yeah. I saw him at the press conference. He was very excited.
Let's drop that audio in here.
For 65 of my 81 years, I have spent at universities all over the country and all over the world. There is no more important event in those 65 years to turn universities away from being bastions of hatred and discrimination than this executive order being signed today. It is a game changer. It will go down in history as one of the most important events in the 2,000-year battle against anti-Semitism. Thank you, Mr. President. You did a great, great job. The people who helped you do this did a great, great job, and you will be remembered by history for all time for having signed this very important order. Thank you.
That was Dershowitz. He wasn't alone. A lot of people thought that was that this was kind of the start of saying that we, the Jewish Americans, aren't Americans. Of course, it hits the dual loyalty trope. And I happen to know the guy who wrote the advisory for the Obama administration that Trump's executive order simply affirmed. He's been on this show. And he says that the order changes exactly nothing. And I read the order and I was like, where is this thing that is supposed to be so terrible? And I don't know. What do you think happened here? Did the Times get played by Trump? Their story came out before the draft of the order did.
Well, Trump definitely had an interest, I think, in genning up like actual interest in this executive order, because I watched him at the press conference that accompanied him signing it, and it was this whole production. You know, he brought a 12-year-old Jewish kid on stage who was wearing a Trump yarmulke. Like he brought up Robert Jeffries. Like, it was this whole spectacle where they talked about how Trump is the real, you know, he's the president that really cares about Israel, because he's the one that moved the embassy to Jerusalem. And we built this big, beautiful building in Jerusalem for $350,000. And he went on and on and on. And everyone who spoke just praised him. And I think, like, definitely possible that this was a classic, you know, gin up interest, gin up controversy, and then every single network carries live this otherwise obscure executive order where everyone who's brought up on stage is praising Donald Trump.
No, that's a good point. And of course, Pastor John Hagee was there. He's the head of Christians United for Israel. He once called Adolf Hitler, quote, a hunter sent by God who is tasked with expediting God's will of having the Jews reestablish a state of Israel. So happy Hanukkah to everybody. That was as they lit a menorah in the White House. Happy Hanukkah.
Yeah. It was pretty wild. You know, again, speaking of the holidays, it's such a joyous time. Apparently Utah is ringing in the new year by expanding Medicaid requirements. So among other things, you can't get Medicaid coverage unless you've applied for a job with 48 employers.
48 employers.
That's so a lot of LinkedIn.
That is crazy. So basically, it's like, so Utah, the voters expanded Medicaid. There was a referendum. They put it to the voters. It's a very conservative state, obviously. And they said, this is crazy. We're going to vote to expand Medicaid. And what the regime has to do is go and get a waiver for these kinds of Medicaid, these kinds of work requirements. They have to go to CMS. That is to say Utah has to go to CMS and get a waiver in order to do this. The Trump regime signed off on this. That is what the story is, and this 48 employers, like, oof, that's some serious job hunting.
Yeah. Plus, in addition to job training workshops and online evaluation, seems like they're just creating all this paperwork.
It's so cruel, and they're rolling this out for the holidays. It's just, you know, David Edwards, our producer, wrote about a similar work requirement that was unveiled in, it was in South Carolina. And what makes this a little different is that it's the first non-expansion state to impose these work requirements. And a lot of people think that these, you know, that poor people are eligible for Medicaid, you know, very poor people. And that's not the case. In most of the red states that refuse to expand, it doesn't matter what your income level is. Mm-hmm. If you don't have kids, you can't be eligible for Medicaid.
Really?
Others have income cutoffs that are like 20% of the poverty level, right?
Wow.
So it's not people under the poverty line. It's like people making less than 30 or 20%, depending on the state, of the poverty line. And here, South Carolina has gone and made their non-expansion Medicaid program that much more difficult. These people are just incredibly, incredibly cruel. But I think the craziest story out of the states this week has to be out of Kentucky. And listen, I'm not easily shocked by Republicans' shamelessness, but this one I was like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. So you have basically Matt Bevin, who just lost an election.
And hated it. He just almost didn't concede, right?
He almost did not concede. As is typical, the Kentucky legislature thought about
stripping
the new incoming governor of his powers, which is what they just do when they lose elections.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Just
a thing.
They're just like, yeah, that's like the
commonplace.
Yeah. So Bevin wants to, he's just pissed. It's his last day in office, and he pardons all these people. This includes someone convicted of raping a child, a guy who hired a hitman to kill his business partner, a guy who killed his parents. And here's the one that I find the most crazy. Bevin pardoned a guy who was convicted of breaking into a house and murdering the homeowner. Remember the castle doctrine? You know, your home is your castle. Mm-hmm. Murders the homeowner, and his family hosts some fundraisers. This guy's only been in jail for 2 years he got a 19-year sentence. Mm-hmm. His family hosts some fundraisers. They raise $21,000. $21,000. Like, it's so cheap.
It's so cheap.
He's so cheaply bought, right?
Oh,
$21,000, and Bevin pardons the guy.
Jeez.
And he comes out with this elaborate thing. Oh, I don't know. The evidence wasn't so strong, blah, blah, blah. The judge who presided over the trial is like, I've never seen a case that was such a slam dunk. This guy is just guilty, guilty, guilty. Mm. And here's the rub. This guy pulled the trigger. He had two accomplices. They did not. They're going to sit in jail for their entire terms because their families did not raise $21,000.
God,
Jesus Christ.
I can't think of a bigger fuck you to just your constituency, just all of Kentucky.
Just everybody. Just fuck you, Kentucky. Thank you. Enjoy some child rapists and murderers. I'm just going to let them go.
Awful. Ridiculous.
What craziness. Anyway, with that, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to We've Got Issues. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Alex Finley. Alex is a former CIA officer, and she writes for Just Security and Slate, among other outlets. I first read her at Just Security, which is a .org, not a .com, if you're interested in checking out her work. Alex, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I think we've become accustomed to the Trump regime's willingness to lash out at anyone, including members of their own staff, as we saw with several witnesses during the House Intelligence Committee's impeachment inquiry. We've certainly become accustomed to their tenuous grasp of facts. So now we have Attorney General William Barr, who ostensibly works for the American people as the nation's highest law enforcement official, disputing basically the key finding of the FBI's Inspector General report because it conflicts with Trump's deep state conspiracy theories. That is, while the report found a number of procedural missteps in the FBI's investigations into the Trump campaign in Russia, it concluded that the FBI began that investigation properly based on facts, and that it was not tainted by political bias, nor is it a witch hunt or coup d'etat. Let me start by asking you why we should take this spin from Barr more seriously than Trump's other attacks on law enforcement and the intelligence community or federal judges for that matter. What are the ramifications here?
Well, I think we should take all of them seriously. I mean, it's been a constant theme with this administration, and Barr is just sort of taking it to a new level, I think. Barr did very similar when the Mueller report first came out. He, you know, he released very limited and cherry-picked results, you know, of it to set a narrative, and that works because, of course, it's a very lengthy report, much like this IG report. And if you just give a few sound bites and lay out a quick narrative with easy to repeat phrases, that tends to be what catches on. Nuance is by definition complex, and it's a much harder message to get across.
Yeah.
But this isn't new. They've been doing this all along. So I wouldn't say that what Barr is doing is so much more worrisome. I think what was already happening was worrisome.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's interesting that he tried the same strategy that he laid out during the when the Mueller report dropped, that is to say, a misleading summary. The difference between then and now, of course, is that he had several weeks to have that kind of shape the early media narrative before we got more details about what was actually in Mueller's report. And this has come after the IG's report came out. So it's different. I guess what I was getting at is that it's for me, it's more troubling coming from the Attorney General of the United States than from a political actor, than from Trump or Devin Nunes or the bobbleheads at Fox News. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do think that that's true. I mean, I think that Barr, you know, has been pretty clear that he's going to work for the president and not for the people. And particularly since this IG report concerns his FBI, which is under his Department of Justice that he leads. So it is worrisome. And I think one of the other things that was even more interesting about what Barr did was that he traveled overseas to actually ask other governments for information about his own intelligence officers.
Right.
So he traveled to Rome and he traveled to London, and he you know, he specifically asked about the actions and operations of our own intelligence officers. And so to me, that's just very strange, and that doesn't seem right, and very supportive of the people that he supposedly is leading.
Yeah. You wrote recently the Republicans are playing a dangerous game, trying to obfuscate, claiming that Ukraine intervened in the 2016 election on behalf of Hillary Clinton. During the Intelligence Committee's inquiry, Republican members took great umbrage when some of the witnesses said that they were protecting Russia or denying the conclusions of the U.S. intelligence community when they pushed these Ukraine narratives. Can you speak to that a little bit? Are they trying to have their cake and eat it too by saying, sure, we acknowledge Russia's campaign, but look over here at Ukraine?
They are. I mean, I think the narrative shifted on that. They started by just saying it was Ukraine that did this. It was Ukraine. And now they have to sort of admit, yeah, okay, we have to admit that Russia did these things, but Ukraine matters too. And so now it's what I wrote there, this false equivalence. I mean, what Ukraine did, okay, there were a couple of tweets, a couple of op-eds, but they were all signed. And this is very, very different than what Russia is doing, which is running a covert influence operation against many Western democracies. And this is one of where the context matters. You know, what is happening in the United States is not happening in a vacuum. We focus on the politics of it and on Trump, but, you know, Putin is directing this influence campaign against other governments as well. It's happening across Europe and elsewhere. So we need, as the citizens, and we need our government and our leaders to understand this isn't, for Putin, it isn't just, oh, U.S. politics I'm playing with. He's going after something much, much bigger, which is trying to change the international system in his favor, because he cannot compete in the international system with the hand that he has. I mean, today already we saw their one single aircraft carrier is on fire. It was already in port for repairs, and had been, you know, was under a crane that had fallen. So they cannot compete in sort of a, you know, regular state to state competition. And So they can only compete in this sort of asymmetrical way using propaganda. It's much cheaper and it's more effective for what they're trying to do. And the Republicans need to realize that in spouting, you know, these talking points, I think most of them see it as a short-term political gain for them. But they don't realize what they're ushering in is a society that then values false narratives, lies, influence, and propaganda. And that leads us, you know, to a whole different way. Well, what do we want our society to be? And we should not be looking to Russia and saying, oh, this is the type of society that we all want to live in.
Yeah. I think this is a super important point. In fact, I wrote about this the year before last for The Nation. There's a piece called Russia's attacks on democracy aren't only a problem for America. And the thing is that Vladimir Putin has this deep-seated distrust of multilateralism. He sees not only, you know, the UN, but also the WTO, the Paris Accord. He sees all of these as constraints on his ability to pursue his own interests or the Kremlin's interests. And long before they meddled in the 2016 election, they had developed this model across the former Soviet bloc countries. And the Western Europeans take this very, very seriously. And it's not a partisan issue over in Europe. So I really appreciate you bringing up that point. The media are covering the report by the FBI Inspector General, that's Michael Horowitz is his name, I should have mentioned that, as something of a win for both sides of this debate, right? On the one hand, it entirely undermines the deep state coup narrative that Trump and his defenders have been peddling for the past 3 years. But on the other hand, as I said during the intro, the IG did find some serious errors in how the FBI obtained FISA warrants, most notably in connection to Carter Page, who I should note has never been charged with any crime. You may remember that according to the FBI, there was a Russian spy ring that tried to recruit Page way back in, I think it was 2013, and concluded that while he was like an ambitious climber, which is good for them, he was also, quote, an idiot. So anyway, that's an aside. What do you think about that framing about the IG's report being reported as a vindication for both sides here?
So I think that indeed it's a vindication for the side of saying that Trump and his people calling this a deep state coup is totally ridiculous. So I think that side is certainly vindicated. It is true that the IG uncovered a number of bureaucratic problems and problems with the FISA process. I'm not at all an expert in FISA, so others can talk to that. But my understanding is there have been issues with the FISA process for years. Yes. And people have been yelling and screaming about those. So, you know, maybe now those things will be addressed. One of the things I found interesting, too, is, you know, there's the report raises this issue that that Carter Page was also an operational contact of another government agency. And, you know, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, was created so that all these agencies actually would be cooperating and coordinating. So the fact that the FBI was not completely aware of what this other government agency was doing with somebody who was under a counterintelligence investigation by the New York field office of the FBI is pretty interesting. And so, clearly, not all communications are happening the way they should.
Right.
Additionally, like Christopher Steele's information sort of fell into the bureaucracy through two different ways, right? Through a personal legat that he knew overseas, and then it got filed with the New York field office. And so it never really made it to headquarters. So not everybody knew. So by the time the Crossfire Hurricane team actually had access, even knew about Steele's reporting, it was like 2 months later.
Right.
So clearly, it's not just the FISA stuff. There are bureaucratic issues where not everybody is coordinating and seeing each other. But that also kind of worries me, because most of Horowitz's recommendations, in fact, deal with how that we need to create protocols and we need to create regulations to deal with these things. And that, for me, always is worrisome, because you don't want so much bureaucracy that nothing happens. Now, clearly, if there are issues where the FBI is overstepping and surveillance is too much or something like that, of course, you need to find that balance. But I saw it happen on the intelligence side after 9/11 and after the Iraq WMD issue, and they completely reorganized the intelligence community and they created the DNI, and that caused a lot of bureaucratic issues that are still, I think, being worked out today. So you want to make sure that you're addressing things very particularly and that you're helping and not hindering those inside the bureaucracy. You want to make sure they can still do their job, but you also, of course, want to make sure anybody on the receiving end is protected.
Right. From my perspective, these they've been peddling these conspiracy theories about Ukraine, about the deep state coup, etc., in order to muddy the waters, like throw a bunch of stuff against the wall and hope that even if it doesn't stick, it kind of makes people throw up their hands and say, oh, I don't know who to believe. I think that's a basic strategy of Trump's constant kind of relentless bullshit. I think it's a smokescreen, and it gives something for his defenders on Fox News and elsewhere and his base to latch onto. But you wrote recently that the real goal of William Barr, and perhaps the investigator he's assigned to do an independent criminal probe, Durham, which is forthcoming, is to intimidate other members of the intelligence community. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, well, I think that it's both.
Yeah,
so
right.
Clearly, like I said, you know, William Barr traveling overseas and talking to heads of other intelligence organizations overseas, turning it into a criminal probe, which he did a few weeks back, or it was at least announced that it was a criminal probe. Yeah, of course, this is meant so that people inside who are doing the investigations might step back and say, I want nothing to do with any of this, which is understandable, right? These are normal human beings. They have jobs. They don't want to risk being fired. They have pensions, and they've seen people, right? McCabe was fired just before he was supposed to retire and lost part of his pension. And if you've put in 20, 30 years and, you know, suddenly you say, look, if I can just hold it another month, it'll be fine. And then I can just leave. So that may have had an effect on some people. The good news, which I wrote about for Just Security, is that we still see these civil servants coming forward and doing their job.
Yeah.
So the whistleblower, the original whistleblower that we now know about, took that risk and said, this needs to be reported, and did it, and now has a security detail. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Fiona Hill, Ambassador Jovanovich, they all still came forward and they said, this is my duty, is to report to you the truth. So I think at least we do see people coming forward and saying, I don't care about the intimidation, I still just need to say what's true.
Yeah, I wanna ask you if you have any insights into how this is all playing out with the rank and file of the intelligence community. Have you spoken to former colleagues about this?
No. I mean, other than those who I'm friendly with on Twitter, we've had sort of public conversations on Twitter about it, but no.
Yeah. I mean, do you worry about morale in these agencies, or you think that they just soldier on and compartmentalize and say, this is political stuff?
So I think basically they just sort of keep going, but you don't want to idolize them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now we see the FBI has flaws.
Sure.
We see that.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you that CIA and NSA and the others have flaws as well. I wrote an entire novel about the flaws over at CIA. So, I don't want to idolize, but at the same time, yeah, that, look, they're just trying their hardest to do a very difficult job. And so while there are bureaucratic problems and sometimes people get more concerned with their own promotions than in their day-to-day working on an operation, generally field officers who are working on these types of issues are very dedicated and they work a hard job. Their families are with them and they're just going to keep on doing it. Anybody who would be chasing the Russia target anyway isn't going to be cowed and say, I guess I'll just stop.
Yeah.
That's not very likely if you were going after something like that to begin with.
Yeah, it's a poor analogy to what's going on in Washington these days. But I mentioned on Twitter the other day that I had this really erratic boss who would regularly demean us as his staff. And we ended up devoting quite a bit of our work time to just talking among ourselves about how crazy what he was and how his like arbitrary, often belligerent management style made it difficult to do our jobs. And we spent so much time on that, that it did ultimately impacted our productivity. So I don't think that's necessarily going on with the intelligence agencies, but these are human beings. And to have your boss constantly, you know, dumping shit on your head it does affect your approach to the job.
That's true. But I think we also, like you said, we are human beings. And as we saw from the IG report from Horowitz, some, you know, people have political preferences. Some of them also happen to hate, you know, one side and some happen to hate the other side. Yeah. And within the intelligence community, they're humans too. And they probably have a preference because everybody, you know, you vote one way or you vote the other way. So you have a preference, but that doesn't necessarily make it into the office.
Right.
I mean, every now and then, sure, I heard from somebody and I knew probably that person voted for this person or not. But generally, you know, that you're focusing on something else and you're just trying to get the information and get to what's true.
And the IG report really did lay out some pro-Trump and anti-Hillary Clinton bias in the New York field office. And there were some emails between them, yes, saying, well, you know, we will be right on the front lines if Trump moves to kind of lock her up. As always, I want to remind listeners that Spygate, as it has come to be known, it began with a zany Trump tweet. And at the time, even Republicans laughed at the idea that the FBI was spying on Trump's campaign. Kellyanne Conway, if you'll remember, said that the Obama administration could be using the campaign's microwave ovens to spy on Trump. Everybody thought that was hilarious. People like Devin Nunes, who would later embrace the theory, said it was kind of crazy. Trey Gowdy was given a classified briefing on the probe, and afterwards he said to Fox News, and I quote, "He was even more convinced that the FBI did exactly what my fellow citizens would want them to do after receiving that briefing." And the fact that a storyline that began as this Trump tweet that was kind of a fodder for late night comedians and a joke among serious people on both sides of the aisle has since become widely embraced and really an article of faith by much of the conservative movement, that is a testament to the power of the right's media echo chamber. Anyway, Alex Finley, I believe we are about out of time. I just want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd also like to thank Liz Preza and David Edwards, our producer and engineer, and the good folks at Alternate and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, hopefully. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Coming back here to this place year on year, to the spot where we first ever met. And friendships go past, some change or don't last, but this one we will never forget. Cause there's something inside us that forever binds, there's a thread and it ties us together. And I know I will love where I go when it's all with somebody like you. So you wanna run with us? see in your face that you're doubting your place, could we love some?